society, of living among the people, right? It is highly encouraged to have a family. It is highly encouraged to be married, to have children, to have many children on top of that. It is highly encouraged. It is considered the worship of Allah to be married, to have kids, and to earn an income, to go and earn sustenance for your family. Zuhud is unfortunately abstinence from the world. Taqwa, piety, is taken in the wrong sense, where we just stop going to work and become beggars. No, the purpose is to provide for our families. The purpose is to gain wealth and then take that wealth and use it on the path of Allah. Use it to strengthen our communities, strengthen our Islamic centers and our mosques and our Husayniyas, strengthen our fellow brothers and sisters, and all in all, strengthen Islam via our wealth. But of course, while we are gaining this wealth, we should be very careful to not fall in love with this wealth, for our only love should be and must be Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. A beautiful and profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم إني أسألك الأمان يوم لا ينفع مال ولا بنون إلا من أتى الله بقلب سليم.
O Allah, I ask you for the protection of the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil.
وأسألك الأمان يوم يعض يقول يا ليتني اتخذت مع الرسول سبيلا.
And I ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger.
وأسألك الأمان يوم يعرف المجرمون بسيماهم فيؤخذ بالنواصي والأقدام.
And I ask you for protection on the day when the guilty shall be recognized by their marks, so they shall be seized by the forelocks and the feet.
وأسألك الأمان يوم لا يجزي والد عن ولده ولا مولود هو جاز عن والده شيئا
And I ask you for protection on the day when a father shall not give any satisfaction for his son, nor shall the child give any satisfaction for his father. Surely the promise of Allah is true.
Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. In this program I would like to talk about Amir al-Mu'mineen, not that much from the historical point of view, but I would like to share with you some of his words about himself in Nahj al-Balagha. Ali, in the words of Ali, in response to the letter of Muawiyah. This is the early days of the Khilafat of Ali, where Amir al-Mu'mineen, you know, was selected by the Ummah for the first time in the Muslim history. If we really look at what is known as people's choice, this was the first time where the people came to him and insisted on him that we would like you to become our Khalifa and leader, to the extent that he says in the third khutbah that the number of people increased so much that my two sons were being pushed and almost crushed onto me, where people were saying, we will not accept anyone but you now as the Khalifa and the leader. And so there, you know, Amir al-Mu'mineen, basically when he got the bay'at from the Muhajirin and Ansar and the people of Medina, as well as the delegations which have come from Kufa and Egypt, then he basically sat down to clean the corruption which was there. So he was going to dismiss many, many people who were in power in different positions. And one of them was Muawiyah. And Muawiyah, basically, he was a very shrewd politician. He wrote a letter to Amir al-Mu'mineen. And the whole purpose of that letter was to provoke Ali, you know, in such a way that Ali will end up writing disparaging remarks about the three Khalifas who came before. And then he would use that writing of Ali among the people of Sham to say, see, he is against the Khulafa that we believed in. Amir al-Mu'mineen responds to his letter. But Amir al-Mu'mineen knew his reason and his motivation. And so Ali responded without giving him the opportunity to misuse his letter. You know, in right in the beginning, Muawiyah, basically to provoke him, started praising Rasulullah. That, you know, alhamdulillah, we had Rasul in our tribe of Quraysh, and this and that, he was this and he was that. And after him, you know, we had the Khulafa. He mentions one, then the second, and the third, and their accomplishments. This was all done in order to provoke Ali against the Khulafa. And Amir al-Mu'mineen knew his motivation. So he now responds to him, and this is in letter number 28 in Nahj al-Balagha, where first Amir al-Mu'mineen says, I'm really surprised and, you know, amazed by you, Muawiyah.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Russia, Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Pakistani politicians and former top civilian and military officials are in the spotlight after they were named in Pandora Papers scandal. There are as many as 700 Pakistani politicians, retired civilian and military officials whose names surfaced in the scandal. Among them also included sitting ministers and close aide to the Prime Minister Imran Khan, whose government came into power in 2018 with a pledge to end rampant corruption. Pandora Papers are based on 11.9 million documents from 14 firms, mostly in British Virgin Islands and the US, where many world leaders and top officials, including from Pakistan, hid their allegedly ill-gotten money by setting up anonymous offshore companies.
How ironic it is. Look at the sheer numbers of military generals and bureaucrats and members of current government who have been named in Pandora leak. They all are involved in this mega corruption.
Prime Minister Imran Khan has ordered an investigation into the scandal.
Although Mr. Imran Khan has been presiding over a team of these crooks and gangsters who have now been exposed in these Pandora's leaks, he has been closely working with these ministers whose names have come up. But at the same time, he would like to distance himself from these crooks and gangsters in the name of the so-called investigation that he is likely to initiate very soon.
Prime Minister Imran Khan's predecessor Nawaz Sharif was ousted from power in 2017 for possessing overseas assets beyond known means of their income after a similar scandal known as Panama Papers surfaced. Since then, many tax amnesty schemes have been introduced to legalize the hidden wealth of politicians and officials in and outside Pakistan in return of tax penalties. Therefore, many believe the corrupt elements are likely to get scot-free once again. Pandora Papers scandal is likely to die down in Pakistan given the fact that this time around the powerful military seems to have no appetite to play its role to oust the current government, unlike in 2017 when the military fully backed the judiciary to oust the then Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif after he clashed with the army on issues linked with the foreign policy. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Al-Qassam Brigades, the military wing of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, has held a huge festival in the Gaza Strip to commemorate five Palestinians who were murdered in Al-Quds and the West Bank a week ago. Hundreds of Palestinians attended the festival, raising Palestinian flags and banners, hailing the Palestinian resistance and the martyrs.
These events held in praise of our Palestinian martyrs and their families in the West Bank. Those heroes prove that the rights of Palestinians are red lines. Palestinian resistance movements are gathered here stressing that we're all united in this battle against Israeli occupation, and the resistance will always be our only path to restore our rights.
Earlier, Israeli forces conducted a series of arrest raids against suspected Hamas members across the occupied West Bank, triggering clashes in which five Palestinians were killed and two Israeli soldiers were seriously wounded.
We are proud of the martyrs who lost their lives while defending Palestine. Our message to the Israeli regime is that we will continue to resist and teach the new generations to follow the footsteps of those who sacrificed everything for Palestine. The Israeli regime keeps killing and arresting our people in the West Bank on a daily basis, and these violations must be seriously dealt with.
Palestinian resistance leaders also attended the festival. In their speeches, Hamas leaders stressed that the resistance is the only option for dealing with the Israeli occupiers. They also stressed the need for promoting the spirit of resistance among new generations so they continue to fight until the rights of Palestinians are fully restored.
Palestinians here stick with resistance to restore our rights in a forceful manner, as this is the only way to defend Palestine. Those martyrs chose their path and insisted on sacrificing themselves for Palestine. Hamas stresses that We are all united in the path of resistance, and the Israeli regime must be aware that we won't give up. Our brothers in the West Bank always support us, and in return, we will defend them.
Palestinian factions here express their loyalty to the Palestinian workers who have lost their lives defending Palestine and vow that their blood won't go in vain. They also express that the battle against this occupation is ongoing until complete freedom. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
A Sassari appeals court suspended a hearing regarding the extradition to Spain of former Catalan separatist leader Carles Puigdemont. The Italian judges have determined that a rule on the matter will be made after the European Court of Justice announces its verdict on Puigdemont's immunity. The politician's immunity, linked to his election as a member of the European Parliament, was lifted earlier this year by the EU General Court.
Catalan separatist leader Puigdemont is wanted by Madrid on charges of sedition for leading a Catalan bid to declare independence from Spain in October 2017. Separatists' short-lived declaration of independence triggered a major political crisis with Spain, during which Puigdemont and several others fled abroad.
Italy's judges have made their call, and now it's up to the European Court of Justice to make theirs. The case is also a test of judicial cooperation between European countries, which have ruled differently on the same issue.
A German court refused to extradite Puigdemont to Spain on rebellion charges in 2018, simply arguing that the Catalan leader was not punishable under German law. Some Italian lawmakers have slammed Puigdemont's arrest in Sardinia last month, saying it was a dark page in Italy's democracy.
The arrest of a politician whose only wrongdoing, in inverted commas, was organizing democratic elections is a worrying signal. If this is how we deal with forces that gather the support of millions of people against central governments, we should all be worried.
The Sassari court will set a new date after the European Court of Justice decides on the immunity of Puigdemont and on the legitimacy of the Spanish judge to issue the arrest warrant. Meanwhile, Puigdemont is free to travel as he pleases. For the time being, Max Civili, Rome.
Palestinians rallied on Monday in front of the Red Cross office in Gaza in solidarity with thousands of prisoners held in Israeli jails and detention centers. The event comes as several Palestinian political prisoners continue their hunger strike to protest their inhumane conditions. Suffering of Palestinian prisoners has multiplied following last month's heroic escape of six prisoners from Gilboa, a maximum security prison in occupied northern Palestine.
Following the historic escape of several inmates from the Gilboa prison, Zionist forces have placed all Palestinian prisoners under unprecedented, deplorable conditions. Many of them have been placed under solitary confinement and were tortured over suspicion that they had helped the six prisoners. Currently, the prisoners are subjected to 60 types of punishments inside Israeli jails and detention centers, which is a clear violation of international laws and norms.
Last month alone, the Israeli regime forces arrested 350 Palestinians, including 36 children and 11 women. Rights activists say Palestinians held in Israeli jails will continue to suffer as long as the world keeps turning a blind eye to Tel Aviv's violations of their rights.
Prisoners on hunger strike are suffering as the world keeps turning a blind eye to Israeli violations against Palestinians. Some of the prisoners have been on hunger strike for more than 80 days. We call on the International Committee of the Red Cross to exert real pressure on the Israeli regime to end its systematic violation of prisoners' rights, especially women and children.
Every Monday for the last 30 years, Gazans have staged protests outside the office of the Red Cross to condemn Israel's inhumane treatment of thousands of Palestinians incarcerated in 24 Israeli jails. Palestinian prisoners resort to hunger strike to draw attention to their suffering, especially under Israel's so-called administrative detention, a policy under which people are held for an indefinite period without charge.
We are here to support Palestinians who lost their freedom while fighting for Al-Quds and for the liberation of Palestine. I call on Arabs to wake up and support the Palestinian prisoners. The prisoners need re-election to highlight their ongoing suffering inside Zionist jails.
Palestinians are calling on the international community to come out of its silence and help their loved ones who were incarcerated illegally by the Israeli regime.
Currently, there are over 500 Palestinians jailed without charge or trial under administrative detention. The Israeli regime has arrested almost 1 million Palestinians since 1967. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
A 12-year-old boy, the grandson of Iran's health minister, Bahram Einollahi. Mohammad Sadra received a Sinopharm shot with the presence of the health minister and local media outlets to encourage Iranian families to vaccinate their children with peace of mind.
I urge all families who have children between the ages of 12 and 18 to send their kids for vaccination. This way we can reopen in-person school classes safely in the upcoming months. I brought my grandson today to get the vaccine to prove that vaccines will bear no harm for children.
Iran has so far administered more than 58 doses of COVID vaccines. This means 68% of Iran's population has received at least one shot. This number was less than 10% around 2 months ago, when President Ebrahim Raisi took over power from his predecessor. Iran managed to accelerate the inoculation campaign by speeding up imports of foreign-made jabs, as well as supporting local vaccine developers.
Only in Tehran, more than 10 million people have been fully vaccinated. This is over 70% of the capital's population. The vaccination of lower ages will definitely help us get our kids back to school safely.
Based on the international health guidelines, minus 18 age groups should receive a single dose of COVID vaccine. The Iranian health minister said the country has taken the same approach and will administer one shot to its adolescents. He said once this phase is over, the health ministry will start vaccinating students between 7 and 12 years old.
While Iran lagged behind in the national inoculation program, it has managed to be among the first to inoculate its teenage population. If all goes as planned, children can go back to schools in less than 2 months. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Palestinian farmers have held a rally outside the United Nations headquarters in Gaza City to condemn the Israeli ban on the export of their produce to the occupied West Bank and abroad. The Palestinians handed a letter to the representative of the United Nations, also protesting the obstacles and restrictions imposed by the Israeli regime on the international marketing of their crops.
The price of tomatoes is dropping and we are not making any profits. This is because there is no export to the West Bank or any other country. Palestinian farmers are living in hard conditions and have a limited source of income. The Israeli regime forces us to remove the tomatoes covers for exports, and this causes damage before they make it to the markets. We want the borders to open so that we can export our crops, and we demand imports of the required tools for farming.
Palestinian farmers say large quantities of their crops are piled up at Kerm Abu Salem, which is the only gateway out of the Gaza Strip, and are damaged. They say the Israeli regime has imposed impossible conditions on the exports. The Palestinians say they depend on the crops as their only source of income, adding that the regime seeks to destroy their livelihoods.
No crops are allowed to enter other markets. We demand an urgent opening of the borders so our crops can reach the West Bank in the same day they are exported, so the produce get there fresh.
This rally is held to protest the persistent Israeli restrictions on exports of Palestinian crops from Gaza to the West Bank. The impossible conditions that the Israeli regime imposed are aimed at damaging Palestinian crops and preventing the farmers from having a better income. This is a systematic policy to collapse the Palestinian economy and isolate it from the world. Farmers here call on the international community to stop these restrictions. The estimated daily loss for Palestinian farmers is very high.
The Israeli regime keeps imposing restrictions on Palestinian traders and farmers, keeping them from exporting their crops.
Palestinian traders and farmers called on the international community to stop these restrictions that led to serious financial losses and dealt a blow to the Palestinian economy. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
See a ring of steel and a little army of police, think the British Conservative Party. Here in Manchester for their annual conference, with the party leader pitching his Building Back Better mantra yet again. Crashing the party, thousands of protesters from far and wide to tell the Prime Minister he and his clique are not welcome.
There's an array of groups and people who have gathered here today to demonstrate against the Conservative government pretty much everything it stands for, from its domestic policy to foreign policy, from its pandemic response and its position on migrants to its participation in foreign wars and its support for foreign occupation.
And they say examples of the government's failures aren't too difficult to find.
There's a gigantic economic catastrophe threatening the lives of ordinary people. There's a gigantic climate catastrophe threatening the whole planet. There is every reason why we can't trust a government of the rich, for the rich, to deal with these problems.
Another reason that's brought these demonstrators here, the controversial policing bill that gives UK police sweeping powers.
They don't need more powers. They need to be engaging with people in a protective way, not in a way where it's oppressive.
As a result of what critics call conservative government inaction, the UK has experienced one of the highest COVID death tolls in the world, massive economic downturn, a humiliating retreat from Afghanistan, hiking taxes, fuel disruptions, and a rise in Islamophobia and xenophobia in recent years.
I want to make it really clear to the Tories that they're not welcome in this city, that actually their position on fueling racism, targeting refugees, is absolutely disgusting, and therefore we want to make sure that they know just how angry we are.
A decade of conservative rule in the UK has led to a groundswell of public dissatisfaction, which experts say will manifest itself in the 2024 general election. Saeed Pourreza, Manchester.
The Iranian radar system, dubbed Shams, can create simulated electronic warfare scenarios to train fresh military personnel. The system was unveiled together with other defense equipment, all built by the Iranian Army's Air Defense Force.
The fully indigenous Shams system is a long-range radar simulator and allows us to design and execute a range of war scenarios. This way we can enhance the preparedness of our staff members against potential missile attacks and other aerial threats.
Hormuz was another radar system that was put into service on Saturday. It's a medium-range tactical radar capable of detecting and tracking air targets at high, medium, and low altitudes. Iran's Air Defense Force says the new equipment will significantly increase the country's air defense capability.
The major feature of Hormuz's radar system is that it can calculate the speed of the target while accurately calculating the distance and sending the data to the fire control systems. I should say that all of the equipment unveiled today and earlier were designed and produced using domestic know-how. We no longer need to import any such equipment from other countries.
Iran has for four decades been under U.S.-led arms embargoes, which prevent the country from purchasing any foreign-made arms. This has over the years prompted the Islamic Republic to try to develop its own weapons to ensure its security. Every year, the country unveils a range of domestically built defense equipment, from UAVs to missiles, as a show of its military might against the backdrop of U.S. sanctions.
The Islamic Republic views U.S. sanctions as a tailwind that has pushed the country toward self-reliance. While these latest military equipment can be counted as a case in point, army officials say this is just the tip of the iceberg, as Iran has indigenized over 80% of its defense arsenal. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Pakistan has lost tens of thousands of its citizens and security personnel since late 2001 when Islamabad joined so-called U.S. war on terror. Pakistan provided the U.S. with its military bases to carry out attacks on Afghanistan and allow the NATO supply line to pass through Pakistan to the neighboring country. But it all backfired with the retaliatory attacks and massive public resentment against the US and successive governments for supporting American imperialistic agenda across the region. After recent humiliating exit of US from Afghanistan and the return of Taliban government in Kabul, Islamabad has changed its pro-US policy. Now Pakistan has decided to bring an end to 2-decade-long violence through negotiation with the different groups working under the umbrella of Pakistani brand of Taliban movement and other groups engaged in insurgency in southwestern Balochistan province.
In fact, I think some of the Pakistani Taliban groups actually want to talk to the to our government, for some peace, for some reconciliation. And we are in talks with some of the groups. I do not believe in military solutions. I'm anti-military solutions. So I always believe that, as a politician, political dialogue is the way ahead.
Before the change of guards in Kabul, Pakistan blamed India to have been using different militant groups from Afghan soil to fan insurgency in its southwestern and northwestern regions bordering with Afghanistan.
The Ashraf Ghani government and other hostile governments in Kabul were providing them conducive conditions to attack Pakistan. But now that the Taliban are there and Taliban have guaranteed or have assured Pakistan that the Afghan land will not be used will not be allowed to be used against Pakistan.
Many militant groups have repeatedly attacked in Pakistan on Beijing's economic and geostrategic interests linked with its global project known as Belt and Road Initiative. The mega project starts from Chinese province Xinjiang and passes through nearly 3,000 kilometer long road network of Pakistan before sailing through Arabian Sea to reach onwards rest of Asia, Africa, and parts of Europe. Both Washington and New Delhi have publicly opposed the China's mega project, which has challenged the economic hegemony of the U.S. Now Islamabad wants to win over the terrorist groups through a reconciliation process in an effort to wean them away from the foreign powers, using them to disrupt over $50 billion investment of China in Pakistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
the limelight.
Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, has outlawed mask requirements in the state and threatened to withhold the salaries of superintendents and county school board members who issue them for students. As infections soar among children, some of the state's biggest school districts vowed to flout the governor's order. We now present you an article written by David Smith. The piece is titled, U.S. Republican Leaders Fiddle While COVID Burns Through Their Own Supporters. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. The crowd gathered under a tent at the water's edge, their tables decorated with the stars and stripes and checked tablecloths. In their midst in Austin County, Texas, last Saturday, 7th of August, was the state's governor, Greg Abbott, laughing with delight and playing the fiddle. With the coronavirus roaring through the state and hospitals near breaking point, comparisons with Nero fiddling while Rome burnt were irresistible, although journalist Alicia Grosso pointed out on Twitter, Nero actually enacted sweeping relief effort to try to quell the fire and also offer his people aid in the aftermath, particularly the lower class. So Abbott is somehow worse than a Roman emperor known today as being a psychotic tyrant. But Governor Greg Abbott, who has banned mask requirements, is far from an outlier in a Republican Party which, having long sought to downplay the climate crisis, is now offering a confusing, incoherent, and anti-scientific response to the biggest public health crisis for a century. Some Republican leaders are seeking to support Joe Biden's efforts to beat the pandemic by encouraging the public to get vaccinated as soon as possible. But others are actively trying to undermine the president's offensive by embracing what critics regard as a lethal mix of ignorance, irrationality, and nihilism. These Republicans seem intent on scoring political points by appealing to a pandemic-weary public's yearning to get back to something like normal life. Still enthralled to former President Donald Trump, they fiercely oppose wearing face masks or vaccine mandates by invoking traditional party tenets of individual freedom, personal responsibility, and resisting state interference. With America now averaging about 113,000 cases a day, an increase of nearly 24% from the previous week, and hospitalizations up by 31% from the week before, Republicans stand accused of causing the deaths of their own voters, as the highly contagious Delta variant of the coronavirus skies through red states where vaccination rates are low. Elaine Kamark, a Democrat who served in the Bill Clinton administration, said bluntly, "They've gone out of their minds. That's just no other way to describe this. This is about the dumbest thing you could imagine, because the only people listening to them are their own voters. So this is the first time I've ever seen a political party advocating things that would harm their voters, maybe even kill their own voters." For 6 months, the vaccine program was an example of American ingenuity, energy, and can-do spirit. But more recently, it has become a yet another case study in the self-inflicted wounds of polarization, reviving a sense of anxiety, uncertainty, and pessimism. In the past week, Florida and Texas, states whose leaders take pride in riding the Biden administration, have accounted for nearly 40% of new hospitalizations across the country. Governor Greg Abbott banned mask mandates, yet pledged to bring extra healthcare workers from out of state and ask hospitals to postpone elective surgeries. The Austin and Dallas independent school districts have said they will defy Governor Greg Abbott's ban and require wearing face masks in schools. Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, has also outlawed mask requirements in the state and threatened to withhold the salaries of superintendents and county school board members who issue them for students. As infections soar among children, some of the state's biggest school districts have vowed to flout the governor's order. Chrissy Noem, the governor of South Dakota, welcomed hundreds of thousands of people to the Sturgis motorcycle rally, where no face masks or vaccines are required, while Henry McMaster, the governor of South Carolina, declared, "Mandating masks is not the answer. Personal responsibility is the answer. Common sense is the answer. And we have an abundance of both in South Carolina." At the White House on Thursday, 12th of August, Joe Biden expressed frustration with governors prolonging the pandemic. He said, "I know there are a lot of people out there trying to turn a public safety measure, that is, children wearing masks in school so they can be safe, into a political dispute." He added, "And this isn't about politics, this is about keeping our children safe." Critics say the governors have abandoned the conservative principle that decisions should be made at a local level, but they have support from prominent Republican senators such as Ted Cruz of Texas and Rand Paul of Kentucky. Rand Paul, a licensed physician and senator from Kentucky, urged civil disobedience against coronavirus restrictions, saying in a video, "It's time for us to resist. They can't arrest all of us." He has been banned from YouTube for a week over a post that questioned the efficacy of wearing face masks. President Biden's efforts is also being undercut by prominent conservative media figures, including the Fox News hosts Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham, who have challenged the safety and questioned the effectiveness of the vaccine, as well as online conspiracy theories that falsely suggest that it harms fertility, contains microchips, or even creates vampires. Democrats are dismayed by such willingness to turn even a matter of life and death into a partisan issue. They note that a minority of the population is hampering the entire nation's recovery and needlessly endangering more lives, including the lives of children. Bob Shrum, a Democratic strategist, said, "They share a profound irresponsibility. What they're doing will sicken people and some people will die. In my view, Ron DeSantis and Greg Abbott are both doing it for political purposes to satisfy their base. DeSantis, at least, is too smart to not know what he's doing or not know what he should be doing. But that's what we've come to in this country." The resurgent pandemic has also exposed fault lines in the Trump-era Republican Party, a contradiction embodied by the former president himself. Donald Trump continues to trumpet his success in developing the vaccines, and quietly received one in January, yet often seems reluctant to encourage his supporters to follow suit. Mitch McConnell, the Senate minority leader frequently at odds with Donald Trump, has paid for advertisements in Kentucky, urging his constituents to get vaccinated, citing his own childhood struggle with polio and the decades it took to develop a polio vaccine. KIV, the governor of Alabama, has spoken out about her frustrations with the unvaccinated. She said recently, "Folks supposed to have common sense, but it's time to start blaming the unvaccinated folks, not the regular folks." She added, "It's the unvaccinated folks that are letting us down." Asa Hutchinson, the governor of Arkansas, has admitted that he regretted signing a ban on mask mandates in schools and asked the state legislature to reverse the decision. He said, "I signed it for those reasons that our cases were at a low point." He added, "Everything has changed now, and yes, in hindsight, I wish that it had not become law." Sarah Sanders, a former White House press secretary who's running for Arkansas governor, published an opinion column about why she decided to get vaccinated, citing Donald Trump and his family's own shots as one reason. If getting vaccinated was safe enough for them, I felt it was safe enough for me. But stopped short of telling others to do likewise, advising, pray about it, discuss it with your family and your doctor. Ron DeSantis and Greg Abbott are both facing re-election contests in 2022 and seen as potential presidential contenders in 2024, which might help explain why their responses are targeted at a Trump base, while Asa Hutchinson and Kay Ivey are more pragmatic. Other Republicans have an eye on next year's congressional midterm elections, which they hope to turn into a protest vote against Joe Biden. Joe Walsh, a former Republican congressman turned Trump critic and radio host, says, "It's where their votes are. I interact with the Republican base every day. They're still highly skeptical or resistant to vaccines. They're up in arms against any sort of wearing face masks and mask mandates. So I hear that every day from the base. If I'm hearing that, then you know these Republican office holders are hearing that as well. So they're just going to cater to that." Asked why voters feel this way, Joe Walsh said, "They're predisposed to believe a lot of this, but it's also said to them every day by people like Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham and talk radio, the world I come from. Like Republicans, elected officials, they know where their audience is, so they feel this every day and they feel it every day, so they bounce back off each other." Joe Walsh noted, "Look, typically midterm elections are all about turnout, and if Republican elected officials go squishy on wearing face masks and even vaccines, people are not going to come out and vote, so they can't do that." But Michael Steele, a former chairman of the Republican National Committee, argues that such a strategy will prove counterproductive in the long term. Michael Steele said, "Never before in history of our country, where we've had to confront national crises, have elected officials behave so badly, so disingenuously, and with so much disregard for the safety and security of the American people."
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Axel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zayd Al-Salami. A few years ago I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We're up to part 3 in Mafatih Al-Hayat, and this is also an interesting section in the book, and it's related to how we as people deal with the Islamic system. We can understand that governing the Muslim Ummah and ruling over people is one of the Islamic necessities, because that is when Islam will be implemented in its whole entirety. This is when you will be able to find a way of living under a utopian kind of society. especially in the Shi'i madhab, in the Shia school of thought, the political dimension of Islam is very vibrant, and you can see it within the ideological process of the concept of imamah. And as we know, imamah is the divinely appointed leadership placed there by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And we will be able to have satisfying results based on religion in areas of politics and society and culture and morality and individual rights and all of these other things, all under the one umbrella of a just ruler. And of course, reality of the matter is, has there ever been a civilization that didn't have a system of ruling? Was the concept of governance something new to the Arabian Peninsula? Is that why Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi left it out? Of course not. It's impossible. There's never been a society that didn't have some kind of system. Even if you were to go to remote, if we could say, indigenous kind of very, very rural areas, you'd still find some kind of system that people followed. And this is exactly why Imam Ali alayhi salam, he resembles a government like a misbaha, like a prayer beads, where we are the beads and the system of government is the thread. With the loss of the thread, the beads are going to fall everywhere. Let me read out the hadith for you.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
As you know, from all that we've been studying in this book, Ayatollah Al-Uzma Sheikh Jawadi Amuli is very selective in the hadiths that he chooses. This hadith is from Nahjul Balagha, and Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, "Makan al-qayyim bil-amr." Al-qayyim or al-qa'im bil-amr means the ruler, the person who is vested in authority to oversee the affairs of the Muslim ummah. "Makan al-qayyim bil-amri, makanul nizami min al-kharaz." Al-kharaz are the beads of the misbaha, the tasbih, the praying beads. Yajma'uhu wa yadummuh. And nidam here is that thread that we're talking about. So the position of a qayyim abil amr, that someone who is ruling over the people, is like the thread in a misbaha that is collecting the beads or keeping the beads together. فَإِنْ قَطَعَ النِّظَامِ, if the thread
was to be cut, then تفرق الخرز, then the beads would fall apart, they would disperse, and it will go away. ثم لم يجتمع بحثافيره أبدا, and you will never be able to bring them back again. This is, of course, something extremely important, and this is also why Imam Ali al-Ridha alayhi salam says this hadith. As I mentioned, it's impossible to find a civilization or a society or a group of people in a community who didn't have some kind of system that they were following. Anna la najidu, this is from Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam, أَنَّا لَا نَجِدُ فِرْقَةً مِنَ الْفِرَاقِ وَلَا مِلَّةً مِنَ الْمِلَلِ. We never see any group of people, any society, any civilization. وَلَا مِلَّةً مِنَ الْمِلَلِ بَقُوا, who stayed, وَعَاشُوا, and lived, إِلَّا بِقَيِّمٍ, unless there was a ruler. وَرَئِيسٍ, and a leader. There was a ruler, there was a leader. وَلِمَا لَا بُدَّ لَهُم مِّنْ, something that everyone, that they needed, something that was necessary for people to have. في أمر الدين والدنيا, in affairs of their religion and affairs of their world, their worldly affairs. And then he says, ولا قوام لهم إلا به, and a society cannot stay upright unless through having a ruler. Which is exactly why, you know, the madhab of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam have always pushed to have some kind of leadership. The Quran says, يَوْمَ نَدْعُوا كُلَّ أُنَاسٍ بِإِمَامِهِمْ. The day will come, which is Judgment Day, where every person, every people will be summoned by their leader, by their imam, by their leader. والحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children's cries.
There was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart, there will always be there, be there.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.